And that was the most painful thing I've ever experienced, I think.
Welcome to Made Us. I am your host, Zach Weaver. My guest this week was dealt a really bad hand in life. But as you'll hear, it never slowed him down, and it never stopped him. Joining me in studio this week is Mr. Kyle Ford. Kyle's story is one that'll shock you, and it's truly amazing. But as you'll hear today, he never let that ticking time bomb in his chest stop him. And that's truly what it was, a ticking time bomb in his chest. And I'm not going to give too much of it away, because in this episode, he really tells the story amazingly. And before I get too far, I got a couple things I want to talk about in this intro that I wasn't able to talk about yet. Last week on Disgruntled Moms, which is another MBI show, yours truly, along with Bob Ruff, was a guest on the first ever Disgruntled Dads podcast, or as we like to call it, the Dad Bod Pod. So if you're interested in having a good laugh, go check that one out. And one other housekeeping note I want to mention before we get too far, and a lot of my listeners might already know this, the cat is out of the bag. Myself and Bob Ruff are getting ready to launch a new project through MBI Studios that we're truly excited about, and we're hoping to launch this project by the end of October. Now, with that being said, this doesn't change Made Us. I'm still going to bring you inspirational stories just like this once a week. But with that being said, as soon as I have all the details of this new project, I'll give it to you, and I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. So after you listen to today's episode, go on to Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star rate and review, and let us know how we're doing. And after you do that, make sure to share the show with a friend. Sharing the show with a friend really makes this show grow and helps get these stories out there. And by making the reach of this show bigger, it can help more people. And really, at the end of the day, that's all that matters. Just being able to help that next person. Being able to help one more person. And to continue helping people. Today's episode's a little longer than normal, which is fine. It's a super powerful episode, and I am super proud of it. But I will warn you guys, at the beginning, Kyle and I have probably a 5 to 10 minute conversation about shooting and shooting sports. So if that's something that doesn't really interest you, don't tune out. I promise you, once we get into the story, it's worth waiting for. Kyle's story is an incredible one, and one that really dropped my jaw today. It's a story that reminds you that as long as you make it through the day, it's a good day, and to truly take nothing for granted. So with all that being said, here's my conversation with Kyle Ford. Kyle, welcome.
Thanks, Zach. Good to be here.
I'm really happy you're here, and it's going to be fun to talk to you tonight. So let's jump right into this and tell listeners a little bit about yourself.
All right. My name's Kyle Ford. I'm 37, married, beautiful little girl, and I've got a really jacked up heart, man. That's about the best way to jump into it.
That's an accurate way to put that, I guess.
Yeah. It's one of those things that it came out of nowhere. It just jumped out from the bushes and pretty much smacked the shit out of me.
Oh, geez. Well, we'll get into that in a minute.
Okay.
So, but I know you're a big 2A guy too, right?
I am. Been a shooter since back in the scouting days and got up here to Michigan. Michigan's got a great 2A culture.
Yeah,
it really does. Especially Southwest Michigan.
Yeah, it really does.
And it just seemed like everywhere you turned, there was always somebody that was like, hey, you want to go out to the range and shoot?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did criminal justice up at Ferris. Got my first real formal instruction on anything outside of like, you know,
Ma and Pa shooting in the backyard.
Yeah, the Woodstock shotguns and rifles and everything like that you get at Boy Scout camp. And I've just been hooked ever since.
Yeah.
A couple years with Van Buren County Marine Division.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Just 1 year full time. And then I was pretty much just on the books as like on call or something.
Okay.
I don't know, for like my last year. I think I went out on the water once, and I think that was 4th of July.
Oh, really?
And after that, I was like, I can't make time for this anymore. Because at that point, I was working at the power plant.
Okay.
I've been security at Palisades for going on 15 years.
That's fucking crazy, man. You don't seem like you should be old enough to have a job for 15 years.
I know.
But as I say that, I've been tattooing for 15 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is crazy. So yeah. I'm 35. So that's all I've done my entire adult life.
Yeah. Well, at least you've got people with ink, including myself, yep. to show for it, you know. But been security officer at Palisades for 15 years. a little bit of time as a supervisor. And that was just the perfect excuse to spend a lot of time and money on ammo and training and just soaking up everything about gun culture, two-way culture as I could. And that's did a couple of matches. I think I shot one match with you.
Okay.
You probably couldn't see me from where you were at way up there.
Oh, whatever, man.
Like, you know, and like the... I'm pretty sure you were number one that match. It was like Bend of the River.
I don't know, but yeah, I typically finish pretty high up there.
Yeah, so. And I was like way down at the bottom, mainly because my shotgun skills absolutely suck. And I went to the match with like a pump action Mossberg.
You know, it's funny to go off on a tangent here. Not really a tangent, but to go off on a weird road here. I didn't realize this until I got into shooting. But now that I'm into shooting, I realized that civilian shooters are typically a higher end shooter than any law enforcement, any, you know what I mean? Like, because typically if a civilian is shooting, they're shooting for passion.
Right.
So a guy like me that doesn't have any law enforcement, doesn't have any military background, goes out and trains strictly for the passion of this. Some people get real crazy in the self-defense training. I train for a game. I train to compete. I train to go fast. I'm not the guy that's out there drawn from an appendix holster, you know, trying to do things like What's that from cover. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. But I'm not that guy.
Right.
I'm the guy that's out there training to go fast.
Right. And it shows.
Which, I mean, when we get to matches, it shows.
Yeah.
You know, you would assume that like military personnel or law enforcement, you'd think because, oh, these guys carry a gun all the time, that there would be phenomenal shots.
Right.
Very, very lacking.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah.
I've met a lot of cops that really weren't gun guys.
Well, and here's
outside of the job.
Here's one of my thoughts with it too. And because I tattoo a lot of law enforcement, I know about what their ammo budget is.
Yeah.
Or about how many rounds they use to train their law enforcement for a year. And I personally shoot about double that myself in a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're using that amount to train a whole force. And I'm one guy out there shooting double that by myself.
Right.
You know, that trigger time is what adds up. And that's anything. You know, and I talk about that in the shooting aspect, but that really goes for anything. If you can put the proper amount of training in,
yeah,
you're going to succeed at whatever you do. Yeah, it doesn't matter what it is. You know, like for me too, it's like tattooing. Like it took a lot of tattoos to become proficient at tattooing. People don't realize that.
Right.
You know, I probably tattooed, and this is going to scare some people that go out and get tattoos. It's probably like, it realistically takes probably 3 years, 2.5, 3 years before you are a proficient tattooer.
Now, during that time, are you apprenticing at another shop?
So I was an apprentice for a year.
Okay.
As far as that goes, it's up to your mentor when they kind of quote unquote release you.
Okay.
But I was an apprentice for a year and then I still was being mentored after that in tattooing. But I mean, it really takes like 2.5, 3 years of full-time tattooing before I know that every tattoo I do is going to leave and it's going to be awesome and it's going to heal well. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
You're going to do tattoos that are going to turn out well.
Right.
And then the more you do those, the more often they come. And then you get to a point where you know like every tattoo is going to turn out the way I need it to turn out. And I mean that from a technical aspect. The artistic aspect you can get. But the technical aspect is where it is. You know, that's the muscle memory. That's getting everything exactly where it needs to be.
Right.
And that's just like shooting, like the muscle memory of shooting. Absolutely. And anything like that kind of leads back to that. Like you have to have that repetition in order to get where you need to be.
Yep. It's a highly perishable skill.
It is.
And I mean, even I can notice whenever I've been lacking on the range and I haven't been out putting in the work myself, because it's the same for me. It's a passion. It's something that, you know, I'm good at. I understand even more so lately getting into like the gunsmithing stuff, you know, understanding that technical aspect of it as well. Now it's a little deeper than just making sure that I do everything right on my end, that round goes exactly where I want it to go.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's nice that my job also coincides with my craft.
Yeah.
Right. Which, you know, there's very few things in this world that I understand to the same level that I do firearms, you know, and that's probably going to sound creepy and, you know, whatever. I don't care.
I like it.
you know, just being able to understand that, you know, at a deeper level, I think helps you as as a shooter as well, and having that passion for it is a must. You know, you really have to have that passion for it. I mean, if you're serious about it, if it's something that you love, then, you know, jump right into it and give it all you got.
You know? No, I think that's it. It doesn't matter what it is. It's just making sure you have a passion for whatever you're doing, you know, and that's one thing I try to preach on the show is to try to have that passion. I've been shooting this is my fourth full, like, committed season. I've shot a little before that. I've grown up shooting, so shooting's not unfamiliar to me. And I shot a little bit 5 years ago competitively, but 4 years ago at the beginning of the year is when I decided, like, I'm going to try this. With all that being said, you know, it's having that passion, you know, and as you grow and as you age, you know, your hobbies change, your passions change. I still love shooting. I still have that passion. But now that I've got into podcasting, like, man, it's my new passion. I fucking love this.
Right.
As we were talking before, you know, I was telling you that, like, I love this show and I love that I can try to help people, because that's all I really want to do is just try to get out there and help that one person. And I've gotten emails back saying, you know, I really appreciate this episode. I really appreciate that you've said this. This helped me. And then, like you said, moments after I said that, it's like, yeah, you have that no man left behind mentality of, like, you want to continue to help. And that's important to me, is like to try to continue to help whoever I can. That's become this growing passion I have now, which doesn't mean I don't want to shoot anymore. Like, I still love shooting. I still have a passion for that. But it's your passions evolve, which I think is an interesting human concept, you know?
Right, right. Whether it's something that, you know, we're physically, now we're maybe physically less capable of doing because mm-hmm. of old age, arthritis, you know, whatever. And I personally call shenanigans on that, because, you know, I get to see the old guys out at the Robin Gun Club. It's the whole age and treachery, you know.
Absolutely.
My old man's definitely one of them.
I've gotten fortunate enough to shoot with Jerry Mitchell multiple times.
No kidding.
I've been able to squad with Jerry Mitchell, shoot hand in hand with him, walk stages with him. Greatest shooter of all time. And easily. He still lays it down. You know, he's in his 60s and he still lays it down. He's still one of the fastest guys out there. So, like you said, calling bullshit on that.
Yeah. 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 Whenever my dad got started in the two gun stuff, you know, getting to work with him mm-hmm. and, you know, getting to see him improve over time. I mean, he's making shots now that he was like, yeah, there's no way in hell I'm ever going to make those. You know, 3 years ago, it's like, now he's just like, he pulls them off just second hand.
Yeah.
You know, just to see, and it's a weird feeling, like the foot, you know, the shoe being on the other foot mm-hmm. of, your dad's supposed to teach you, you're not supposed to teach your dad.
Yep.
Right. But just that dynamic has done a lot to keep us close.
That's awesome. To kind of rebuild that relationship.
Yeah. I mean, every guy is always going to say, man, my relationship with my dad sucked, you know, back in the day. But
I heard a statistic.
Like, we're great.
I heard a statistic not long ago that said, by the time you're 18 years old, you have spent 90% of the time you will with your parents, which is mind-blowing.
Dude, that's depressing.
It's super depressing. And especially, like, I think about that both sides. I think about that as a child, thinking that, like, I've already spent more than 90% of the time I will with my parents in my lifetime. But then I think about that as a parent. And I'm like, fuck, my kids, you know what I mean? My kid's 8. Like, we're halfway there. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, we're halfway to that moment. And it's just, it's mind-blowing to think that. But and it makes sense when you do really think about it, though, on a non-dramatic scale. If you just actually put it, like, the aspect of it aside.
You pull the emotion out of it.
You pull the emotion out and you think about it. Yeah, because from birth till 18, you live there. You're with them all the time. You're with them almost every day.
Right.
You know, obviously not 24 hours a day, but you're with them a good portion of the day, depending on school and whatever else. And then typically after 18 is when you move out, you start doing things, you know, and I'm guilty of this. I'm just as guilty as anybody else, but I feel this sometimes, is that I don't see my parents nearly as much as I should. My parents are divorced. I see my mom maybe at most an hour every 2 weeks, and I see my dad maybe once a month. Not that I don't want to see them more, not that they're not here, not that they haven't moved, you know what I mean? Like, and it's a little upsetting to, when you really think about, like, the little amount of time you actually spend with these people that you should be spending more time with.
Right.
You know, especially when you have people in your life that have lost a parent and wish they could spend time with them.
Right.
Where that, like, I don't want to say I'm a selfish asshole, because I'm not being selfish, but you just don't think about, like, oh, I could be spending time with this person and I'm not. Whereas somebody else wants to spend time with their parent and can't.
Right.
So
you're going to make me go see my mom tomorrow.
Good. And I hope that the, whatever
I was planning on anyways, but
I hope that whatever I just said makes everybody want to go like,
yeah, call your mom,
call your dad, go hug them.
Yeah.
So now that we're having a heart to heart.
Wow, dude.
Let's talk about your heart.
Okay. Nice segue.
Nice segue, right?
Oh, that's
it was almost like
for you.
So I know you said this kind of came out of the blue when it originally happened. What originally happened to you?
Okay. So October of 2012, I was in the middle of EMT basic at LMC. I was going to school in the evening. I was working full time, you know, it's just burning it at both ends. And, yeah, in the same way that, you know, a 29-year-old does.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, off time was, you know, kind of hell raising and everything that usually comes around that time of age.
Oh, of course.
So anyways, let's see here, October 2012, I go to get a tuberculosis screen.
Okay.
Because before we were allowed to do our ride-alongs with the ambulance, mm-hmm. we had to be clear of tuberculosis, make sure we weren't like a carrier or we hadn't had it, because it's one of those weird diseases that can lie dormant for a really long time.
That's one of those weird bubble shots, right?
Yeah. That's the one where, so you're going to love this. Okay.
Okay.
So they stick it in your arm. Mm-hmm. It's like a live culture or something like that. And they give it like, I can't remember, 24, 48 hours, something like that. Right.
Yeah.
If it dilates to 10 millimeters, then that's an important number. 10 millimeters.
10 millimeters.
Then you're a carrier.
Okay.
Anything less than that is supposed to be, you're cool. Mm-hmm. Right. No worries. So this wonderful nurse practitioner, and I feel like the biggest asshole in the world because I cannot remember her name, but she literally saved my life.
Really?
Yes. And I actually did go back. I brought her a big bouquet of flowers whenever I got out of the hospital.
Oh, geez.
And was like, you know what? This is for you. Words cannot describe. Right. So anyway, she made the call. She's like, you know, she's sitting there measuring it. She goes, that's about 8 millimeters. She thinks about it. She's like, yeah, let's just do a chest x-ray just to make sure you're not a carrier or something.
Okay.
Like that. And she asks, you know, when was the last time you had a chest x-ray? I couldn't tell you. Mm-hmm. You know, I played sports my freshman year in high school a little bit, but I was mostly a band geek.
Yeah.
You know, so no chest x-rays for, you know, the guy carrying the bass drum. Right. So anyway, she does a chest x-ray and they noticed like this big growth, what looked like a growth, like in the right paratracheal region.
Okay.
So I guess if you go down from your throat, mm-hmm. go down a little way, so about the notch of your clavicle, it was just, there was this big growth right there.
Really?
They thought. She goes, huh, it looks like you've got some type of soft tissue deviation in your right paratracheal.
Hmm.
I said, huh, okay. That's funny because I've had people like checking the alignment of my trachea for like the last month, as that's part of something that you do as an EMT.
Okay.
To make sure there's not obstructions or any type of like breakage or whatever. I'm obviously not an EMT. so they decide to order a CAT scan. I go over to the outpatient center on Hollywood. Mm-hmm. They do a CAT scan, which those are really fun because, and this was the first time I had experienced this, because they inject you with something and she says, you're going to feel like you peed yourself.
Really?
I said, okay. She goes, you'll get like a warm feeling from your arm where I inject this and it'll go up your spine. And as it gets to about your waist, you're going to feel like you pissed yourself. Okay. You didn't, unless you did. Do you want to go to the bathroom now? I said, yeah. Let's make sure one more time. Yeah. I don't want to be that guy who pisses himself in the CAT scan.
Yeah, let's get this out of the way.
Yeah. So, sure enough, it actually does feel like you pissed yourself.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know. It's something with the isotope or the ink or something like that they use to identify. Science beyond me, man.
Because science.
It's because science.
My kid says that all the time. My oldest says that. If you ask him something, he'll go, it's because science.
Like, best answer ever.
You little bastard.
That's like his version of mind your own damn business.
Right? Yep, that's exactly what it is.
I like it. I'm not going to teach Elsa that because that'll be all I hear. But so they call me up about 4 hours later, because that was early in the it was early afternoon. I didn't have to work that night. I was on night shift, and I was getting ready to go out with a couple buddies. And she says, "There's something here. We're not quite sure if we want to do a tighter scan."
Hmm.
So I go back in the next day, do the scan, and I actually had to work that night.
Yeah.
Do the scan, and again, felt like I had to piss myself. And she calls me up and she says, "You have something that we're pretty sure it's a coarctation and a dilation of your aorta."
Okay.
And I said, "What?"
Yeah.
What?
I knew what the aorta was. Mm-hmm. We had spent a lot of time on the heart, and ironically enough, the subjects with the heart and everything during EMT school,
mm-hmm.
fascinating.
Yeah.
I loved it. Could not get enough of it. So she explains it. Basically, a coarctation is like a blockage in an artery.
Okay.
Except it's not caused by, plaque, fat, whatever, building up in there. It's basically where that part of the artery didn't grow to match the same diameter as the rest of it.
Okay.
So if you think of it in a plumbing scale, you've got like 3/4 inch PVC, and all of a sudden it tapers down to like 1/8 inch, and then goes back to, 3/4 inch.
Yeah. You're just never going to have that flow.
Exactly.
Okay.
And as a result of that, the dilation of the aorta from the root of my heart at the aortic valve. And I apologize to Judy Wheeler if I totally just butchered all the alignments and everything there. But as I just got done saying how much I loved studying the heart, from the ascending, basically the ascending aorta had dilated open or had spread out to a point where it was about to burst.
Holy shit.
And aortic bursts are called widowmakers for a reason.
Yeah.
I mean, you could be on the table prepped and ready to go. At the exact point that thing burst, you're still probably not going to make it.
Wow.
Because that is the main pipeline
mm-hmm.
coming out of the heart, okay? Your body will no longer have blood flow. You will bleed out inside, and that because your heart is literally pumping all that blood into an open cavity, which is your body.
Yeah.
It's not going everywhere else that it should. Functions shut down. End of story.
So when she tells you this, I mean, how long before this do you realize what's happening? I mean, did she explain it to you on the phone?
Yeah.
Everything you just explained to me?
Yeah. She explained it pretty well. I'm not quite sure how much of it I caught.
Okay.
She said, "We need to get you in for an MRI of your brain, like immediately."
Really?
So I'm scheduling you one for tomorrow.
So what is going through your mind? Like at this point, like what? I mean, I'd be freaking the fuck out.
I was. Oh, I was. And especially when she said about the MRI for my brain, I asked, "Well, why?" I mean, that's kind of the wrong sector, right? She goes, "Well, this has a tendency to throw blood clots into the brain. We don't want you having like a random stroke somewhere."
Jeez.
I said, "So what am I looking at with that?" She's like, "Pretty much sudden death." That's when I went full bore freak out.
Yeah.
Like I said, I had to work that night. At this point, I hadn't called off in like a year.
Yeah.
I was pretty happy with that, So I call up work, and the poor supervisor answered the phone, real laid back guy. He's like, I said, "What's going on?" I said, "Yeah, dude, I'm calling off for tonight." Okay. What's the reason for the call off? I'm like, "I don't know, dude. How about sudden fucking death? Okay. Is that good enough reason? Is that compelling enough reason for you?" There's just silence. And he goes, "I'm just going to go ahead and put that you're not feeling good. Does that work?"
Does that work?
I said, "Yeah, that'll work."
Holy shit. Are you married at this point?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. When did you tell your wife right away?
Or? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I called her up. She was working at the library. I'm like, "Yeah, hospital called. They found some stuff. We'll talk about it whenever you get home." Cause I was still in the process of like digesting it myself.
Yeah.
Right. All of a sudden, I mean, we had this nice big apartment there in downtown St. Joe. All of a sudden, that thing got real freaking empty.
Yeah.
And it was like, I mean, whenever somebody, you know, uses the word sudden death
mm-hmm.
in a sentence that pertains directly to you.
Yeah.
It tends to kind of throw you off a little bit.
I can imagine.
And it still does to a degree. And a funny story about that later. So they scheduled me the MRI. Obviously, no blood clots in the brain, anything like that. And they assigned me to a doctor over at Lakeland to do this operation. So we went and saw a doctor over there. After a couple of visits that, again, I'm not really sure how much I'd really digested from, because
mm-hmm.
I'm still kind of in like this state of shock.
Yeah.
They come up with a game plan that basically they're going to just, all in one fell swoop, they're going to put a stent in the coarctation and then just replace the ascending aorta with part of the descending.
Okay.
Right.
So they're going to take a part of you and just rearrange it.
Right.
That was the way I understood that idiot terms.
And the way it all just kind of sounded out, just kind of sounded kind of shotgunned.
Yeah.
You know? So as is your right, we asked for a second opinion.
Okay.
And bless her heart, they were totally cool with it. I said, yeah, absolutely. We'll download your stuff onto a CD. We got a whole list of people that we'll happily send you to that we can suggest this to. And that was, I thought that was really kind of decent of them just to say, look, we get it. You're not comfortable. We want you to be comfortable. We'll send you to somebody who's going to make you more comfortable.
Absolutely.
Right.
And you have to respect that.
Yeah. And I think that speaks well for them. So they send me up to this doctor in Bronson. Awesome dude named Alphonse DeLucia.
Okay.
Right.
He sounds slick as hell.
He is. He was slick as hell. You know, probably looks exactly like how you can imagine him. really cool dude. And he's like, he calls us in for a consultation. And I'm a very visual learner. So he actually like sits us down, me and my wife both. And it's like school's in session.
Okay.
Right. He just draws this thing out. Here's the heart. Here's what's going on here. Here's what's here. You know, here's our concerns with just using any old stent off the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to run a battery of tests and stuff here and see if there's any... see what else we can dig up, right? We're going to do our due diligence on this.
Okay.
Which we walked away feeling 110% better after that visit. So we go up there for a visit and they had like all these blood pressure cuffs, different sizes and everything, right? For like the upper arm, lower arm, leg, like fingers, toes.
Really?
The whole nine yards, right? So just in conversation, I said, I never thought I'd ever see a blood pressure cuff for a thumb.
Yeah.
She said, well, that wasn't what it was originally designed for. I said, what was it originally designed for? She goes, well, think pre-Viagra. And I'm like, oh my God, get the penis cuff off my thumb. You know?
Oh, that's awesome.
So yeah, that was, my wife enjoyed that thoroughly because she's, bless her heart, she has been there the entire step of the way.
Yeah.
Right. And the whole, from January on, she was pregnant.
Okay.
She was pregnant with our daughter. So that whole, the whole Bronson thing was, I don't know, late December, early January, somewhere in there. So DeLucia calls my phone. I'm on my way to work. I'm driving up Blue Star. He calls my phone after running all these tests and everything. He says, I'm going to be honest with you, man. This is outside of my wheelhouse.
Wow.
He says, this is outside of our wheelhouse here at Bronson. He goes, I've passed this around to a few other docs. There's just too many moving parts here for us to really feel like we're understanding.
Dude, that's horrifying.
Yeah.
That scares me right now.
So he said, look, I'm going to send you to these docs up at University of Michigan.
Okay.
He goes, I'm going to schedule an appointment with Dr. Amy Armstrong. She's a cath doc, so she'll be dealing with the stent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to schedule you a consultation with a heart surgeon named Rick Oye. He said, the best way I can describe it is, if you were my kid, those were the two I would want you to go to.
Wow.
I said, okay. He goes, and I'm going to basically still be on your team this whole time, but I'd like to get as many people on board with this as I can.
Wow.
He goes, and I'm going to be there for your surgery. I'm going to assist.
Man, that takes a special person.
Yeah. The dude's like an unsung hero of this whole, the whole thing. He's like, just the fact of, you know, a big time heart doc saying, look, I'm uncomfortable with this, mm-hmm. instead of saying, you know, hey, I love a challenge.
Yeah.
And jumping right into it, I thought that was, again, that was.
That speaks a lot.
Yeah. The professionalism meter just like went through the roof. And yeah, I kind of had like a slight freak out at that moment, mm-hmm. whenever he's like, there's too many moving parts for us to understand.
Yeah.
But these docs are the best. And if you were my kid, that's where I'd want you to go.
Yeah. What's going through your head now at this moment? Because you're being told this and you know your wife's pregnant. I mean, this has got to be really weighing on you.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
A lot of sleepless nights, sleepless days, because I was on night shift. It's like, you know, what happens if things go wrong?
Yeah.
You try not to think about that. Mm-hmm. And the doctors do a fantastic job of helping to put that to rest.
Yeah. Try to put that positive talk in your head.
Yeah. They put that, they tell you all the ways that it's not going to go wrong. Mm-hmm. And once Dr. Armstrong, Dr. Oye got to meet me, I was like, we've got this on lock.
Really?
We're good.
That's awesome.
You know, the ironic thing was both of those doctors worked in the pediatric ward.
Really?
Of U of M Heart.
Okay.
And the reason being that they sent me to them was that this condition, the coarctation of the aorta, is primarily a pediatric condition.
Really?
But the easiest way to detect it without a chest x-ray is doing a blood pressure reading on the legs as well as the arms.
Okay.
Now think about your dad, probably take your kids to their wellness checkups. Think about how many times you've actually seen them do a blood pressure cuff on the leg.
Yeah, I don't know that I can ever think of that they did it.
Never. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that if it was that easy to detect that variation, right? Because, you know, the reason there's a variation is like on your arm, your blood pressure might be great because it's on the normal side of the blockage, mm-hmm. right? Your legs are going to have a different blood pressure because they're on that outside of the blockage. Learned a lot about coarctations.
Yeah. I'm making my doctor fucking test my kids.
Right. especially if they have a heart murmur.
Okay.
They said almost everybody that has a coarctation has a heart murmur.
Okay.
At some point, but not everybody who has a heart murmur is going to develop a coarctation.
Makes sense.
So I don't know if it's one of those things where, you know, one necessarily means the other, but I've had a heart murmur since God knows when. My mom can even remember, oh yeah, took you to, you know, the docs whenever we lived in West Virginia and they said, yeah, he's got a heart murmur, but that's pretty common, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and to the doctor's credit, you know, yeah, heart murmurs are pretty common in kids.
Yeah.
You know, especially during puberty, you know, bodies changing, developing, things like that. So I guess the likelihood of, you know, intentionally testing doing blood pressure on the legs and arms, you know, probably doesn't cross the mind a lot.
No, you wouldn't think so.
But it's one of those really easy things. If there's a massive difference between the blood pressure in the arm versus the blood pressure in the leg, mm-hmm. you probably need to look at a chest x-ray just to make sure.
Wow.
And it's one of those things that's like, it's so easy. It's like, hey, if you're done on the arm, do you got one that fits the leg there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, sure. Why not? Wait a second. You know, and you just saved yourself a lot of trouble.
Yeah. I know we got way off topic, but.
Yeah.
Or no, I guess we're not off topic. We got way off on into the weeds, but.
Yeah, we got off on the weeds. We're a little off the timeline, but.
I like it.
It's, I think that's definitely important to put out there.
Yeah.
Especially to parents who have kids with a heart murmur, young children, things like that. If the doc says, yeah, they got a heart murmur. Okay. That A doesn't necessarily mean B, mm-hmm. but. You know,
it's worth looking into.
It's worth looking into, believe me.
Yeah.
We have a friend of ours worked over at Martin's there for a little while, and her son was born with the same condition I had.
Okay.
And here's this kid that's less than a year old, you know, going through the same damn thing.
Wow.
And it's like, they're just happy that they caught it right out the gate.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And this kid's just... He's a dynamo now.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. It's like it never happened other than having a gnarly scar.
Yeah.
that is going to drive the chicks crazy whenever he's older. You know,
don't tell your wife that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I've got like the third nipple. Like there's just like enough scar tissue right above. Seriously looks like a third nipple. Not attractive at all.
So we're leading into that first surgery.
Okay.
And like you said, I mean, there's those sleepless nights. There's, you know, having to go through all of that. That day of your surgery, I mean, are you just, you're just ready to do it?
Yeah. I'm scared shitless.
Yeah.
Not afraid to say it. Now this was going to happen. This was essentially going to happen in two parts. They were going to do the stent first, wait 30 days, and then fix the coarctation.
Okay.
Because they decided that the coarctation was stable enough, or excuse me, the dilation was stable enough that it could wait another 30 days. It could wait a little bit of time.
Okay.
Now the stent that they had to put in there, this was great. The stent that they had to put in there was not approved by the FDA for use in the United States.
Okay.
So they had to apply for a special use permit to get one from Canada to come down here.
Eh?
Eh? Yeah. Thanks, Canada. And thank you, FDA. You know? So they fill out the paperwork. And again, the people at U of M are outstanding. They're social workers and everybody just, they're like, look, you don't need to do anything. We're going to handle it. So they send it off. They said 3 months. They send it off. That was January. March, they call, and I'm like, yes, you know, ready to rock and roll, right? They said, they lost the paperwork.
What?
I'm like, are you shitting me?
Holy shit.
I said, who, you guys or the FDA? They're like, the FDA lost the damn paperwork. I'm like, oh, Christ. Okay. They're like, we're going to submit it again. We're going to have, like, expedited, you know, triple stamped.
Yeah.
Get off your ass and handle this. And sure enough, like first week of April, I get a call. All right, we got you one.
Sweet.
I'm like, yes. Thank you.
Yeah, because this whole time from January till April, October.
Yeah, because I originally diagnosed in October.
So literally from October to March and then from March to April, you're like, I'm going to die. I could die any moment.
Walking on eggshells. Yeah.
Jeez.
And I really tried not to let it get to me.
Yeah, but how do you not let it get to you?
I don't know. Dark humor.
Yeah.
Probably.
There was
a lot of the whole like, hey, well, you know, if you guys don't hear from me in a couple hours, I'm probably dead. You know, it's cool.
That's a tough way to look at it.
You know, oh. And of course, every time I broke out the dark humor, my wife's just like, stop. Just stop. Okay.
Yeah. I'm very much like that too, I have to have that. It's kind of my coping mechanism.
Yeah.
Is that dark humor and just to be able to cope with whatever. It doesn't even have to be dark humor, but just humor is how I cope with it. You know,
right.
It's usually inappropriate.
Yeah. One of the things I started doing with the humor side of it was, you know, for anybody who's worked in a nuclear power plant, we know that we've got like, you know, condition reports and we've got work orders and things like that. I started doing like this series of Facebook pictures holding up a thing that's like reference work order number, like the date of my diagnosis and, you know, parts not available, vendor invalid or something like that. Or just stupid things like that, just to kind of like lighten the mood. It's like, yeah, well, I'm just spare parts here. So, yeah. You know, it's cool.
Oh, geez.
Don't worry about it. So leading up to the surgery, day of the surgery, almost all my family comes in. You know, my brother was living in Columbus at the time. He couldn't make it, but like my mom, my dad, Alicia's family, including her sister's husband and two kids, and everybody just comes up to Ann Arbor and they're there. And I was happy for that. Not so much for my sake, but for Alicia's.
Yeah.
Okay. Cause she's 4 months pregnant at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. She's 4 months pregnant. She needs that support structure. And I was more than happy to have it there. And her whole family is amazing. They live over south of Ann Arbor.
Okay.
So it was just a hop, skip, and a jump for like, you know, her sister family and everybody. And her mom and dad came up. So, you know, the gang's all there.
Yeah.
Right? We go have a nice big dinner and everything. And thus starts the no eating after midnight.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, just the wait.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, report time, 5 a.m. So it's like, all right. I mean, needless to say, I didn't sleep at all that night.
Yeah.
I figured, you know, this is going to be my first time actually being put out. So I guess I'll worry about the sleep side of it later, you know?
Yeah.
So we go there that morning, and interesting part. So they're going through my femoral artery
mm-hmm.
for this. They're like, you need to kind of, you know, shave.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay. I thought I did a pretty good job of it. Apparently I didn't, because I woke up shorn as a fresh baby, as
yeah.
shorn as the day I was born, you know?
Oh yeah.
I was like, do I need to tip somebody for this? Cause this is fantastic. But the surgery didn't exactly go perfect.
Okay. Which is alarming for you to say that.
Right. So my blood pressure decided to spike.
Okay.
In the middle of the surgery. And so that earned me a couple extra days in the ICU.
Oh, geez.
Under observation. And like I said, that was my first time being put out. I'm kind of bouncing around topics here.
No, you're good.
But that was my first time being, you know, put under sedation. And the first time coming out of it was not a pleasant experience, because I woke up to a breathing tube still in my throat.
Oh, geez.
And I'm like clawing at this thing to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, orderlies and the nurses are trying to do their job. And I'm like, you know, wild animal look in my eyes, like trying to get, you know, I was full on fight instinct at that point. And as soon as I was able to speak, which is a loose term, is more like a croak after having the breathing tube in my throat.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first thing I said was, where the fuck am I and who the fuck are you?
Oh, jeez.
And they're like, you're in a kid's hospital. You need to like dial it down a little bit. I'm like, sorry. You know, but they explained to me what was going on. They said, look, you know, your blood pressure spiked. So we're going to keep you in the ICU for a couple extra days.
Okay.
I said, okay. And they said, here's some pain control. Just push this button and, you know, you'll get the little drippy drip.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really like that, to be honest. I didn't like that feeling of losing what little control that I had.
Yeah.
But it was awesome to wake up to see my entire family there, see, you know, Alicia, her family. It was good. It felt like a hurdle. Even at that point, you know, immediately waking up and still having like the whole 30 days of recovery ahead,
mm-hmm.
it still felt like a huge burden had been lifted.
That's great.
It was like, okay, the first step's the hardest kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the first step is now done. So I ended up some extra time in the ICU, and then I can't remember what it's called, kind of like a private room recovery ward.
Okay.
Really nice. Again, like I can't say it enough times. U of M is awesome,
mm-hmm.
especially their kids. Like if anybody ever has issues with their children's heart, U of M, I'll say it right now. That's your number one choice.
Yeah. I've heard that several times too.
Yeah. They're fantastic. So to be honest, like most of the ICU days and recovery ward days for that, kind of a blur.
Yeah.
It was just kind of nice to get home. It was like, look, I'm in my own room, on my own crappy couch, you know, and it was good to be home. Now I had these expectations as like, man, as soon as I'm mobile, man, I'm going to be out there just absolutely kicking ass, cause this is going to be great.
Yeah.
My wife quickly curbed that. She will be the first to tell you that I'm the worst patient ever.
Yeah. Wives are good at knocking you down a peg.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's good, cause otherwise we'd probably all die.
Yeah.
Premature deaths pretty quickly. There was even to the point where like I was driving. I shouldn't have been.
Oh, geez.
So like, you know, she went up with me for the incision checks and stuff like that. And she's like, oh yeah, by the way, he drove up here.
She's throwing you under the bus, like
both hands, man.
Yeah.
No warning whatsoever. And she did it again the next time too. But the next time I understand even more, cause that was actually after they cracked my sternum open.
Oof.
Yeah. Straight up aliens action, man.
Oh man.
Anyways, the next part of the next operation is scheduled for end of May.
Okay.
Just so happens to be my mom's birthday.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, mom.
Yeah. That was the one I was the most nervous about. Cause like I said before, that's the one where they were cracking my chest open mm-hmm. to replace the ascending aorta with a synthetic one. So it wasn't like you said before, you know, taking a piece of you and putting that piece of you
back in, where it was. Yeah. Back in a different spot.
In a different spot. U of M opted for a different and just went with like a synthetic,
like a garden hose.
Probably.
Canadian garden hose.
I think it just depends on what your insurance is.
Oh, gotcha.
So yeah, like my chest x-ray now looks like a Chinese finger trap.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. But so they put a synthetic one, or they were going to put a synthetic one in. And that was the most painful thing I've ever experienced, I think.
Yeah.
Because you don't realize how many motions that you do every day depend on having that central torso area completely intact.
Yeah.
You don't, I mean, even just as simple as opening a bottle of water.
Yeah.
You know, that torsion action that is just, you feel it all the way up, all the way through your chest, all the way back to your spine, because the pain radiates.
Yeah.
And sneezing. Mm-hmm. Single most painful thing ever.
I know that I've seen that they give, you know, when they do open heart, they give them a pillow.
Yeah.
Like that yep. squeezing pillow for that type of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that I never got one of those. Like, I guess some of the children's hospitals give you like a big bear or a big heart.
Okay.
I think they were like, well, he's a tough guy anyways, so he can use a damn pillow like the rest of them.
Yeah.
So I never got the bear or the heart. Thanks, you of him.
Bitch.
But, so yeah, I had to do like these breathing exercises, blowing into this thing that, to be completely honest, looked like a bong.
Yeah.
And that was one of the first things I told the nurse whenever she's like, here, you need to blow into this. I'm like, don't you need to stuff it with something first? I mean, I don't have a lighter, do you? But she's like, no, it's for breathing exercises. You need to keep your, you know, it's for making sure that your lung capacity
mm-hmm.
doesn't deteriorate.
I know exactly time. What you're talking about, because I did it earlier this year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What was?
I had double pneumonia. I was hospitalized. I almost died. It was a big deal.
Dude.
Yeah, it was a ordeal.
Jesus.
Yeah. No, I'll tell you afterwards.
Okay.
My listeners have already heard it. They're tired of hearing me talk about almost dying.
Okay.
So, I mean, maybe they're not, but.
So, anyways, surgery, mom's birthday. That one was the hard one because they had like tubes in the side of my neck.
Oh, wow.
Tubes down my throat. I woke up with a Foley cath still in place.
Jeez.
And the nurse, this guy walks up. He's like, all right, bro, I got to take that Foley cath. I'm like, okay, man, just do what you got to do.
Yeah.
He's like, all right, man, you ready? One, two, three. Pulls that thing. I'm like, oh, we're not bros anymore.
Yeah.
We're so not bros anymore. I'm like, he's like, yeah, yeah, I get that a lot. You know, I'm like, well, you're the guy that gets to pull the tubes out of people's dicks. So, you know,
ouch.
Yeah. I don't expect him to be the one that makes a lot of friends among the patients.
Probably not.
Especially if they're already awake. So I wake up and I'm barely coming to, and my mom's standing there, you know, and it's her birthday and she's a mess.
Yeah.
And I just said, you know, hey, mom, happy birthday. And she just like completely breaks down in tears. But she's been a beast through this whole thing. She's an absolute boss.
Yeah, parents got to be, though.
Yeah. And she's no stranger to, you know, to hospital rooms, to surgeries, to things like that.
Okay.
You know, she shattered her ankle, and I literally mean shattered her ankle whenever she was 37. Multiple reconstructive surgeries on her ankle. They said she would never walk again without a cane. 6 months after that, she was running up and down the sidelines at soccer games for me and my brother.
Holy shit.
So, yeah, she's a trooper.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned before, she has Parkinson's.
Okay.
Early diagnosis. So she actually ends up playing this huge role in me being able to deal with everything that comes after, because
really?
The fact that I've got somebody else who I can share a struggle with,
mm-hmm.
you know, whenever I say, man, freaking hospitals suck, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody who's never been in a hospital before can say, yeah, well, you know, I guess they do.
Yeah.
You know, but somebody who's spent that much time in a hospital room, somebody who's had something that's altered their life from the ground level all the way up, you know, it's good to have somebody that you can connect with at that. And the fact that you know, she's your mom.
Yeah.
You know, means there's already a connection there that, you know, helps, you know, that she's going to understand either way.
Yeah.
Right. She understands on a deeper level, having had her own struggle too.
Yeah. Having to go through some of this stuff, you know, obviously it's not the same operations and whatever, but still having to live in the hospital and go through that mess.
Yeah. She's, I'll be honest. She's probably one of the biggest reasons I'm here tonight.
Yeah.
She took her condition and, I mean, she's head of the Bering County support group for Parkinson's.
Oh, that's awesome.
She's doing like cutting edge deep brain stimulation.
Really?
Which is, I mean, it's not exactly experimental, but it's still, you know, still not mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
To help with her treatment and everything. So, I mean, she has shown absolutely no fear in tackling this.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the fact that she was like, she took her shitty hand that was dealt
mm-hmm.
and just ran with it and played it to the hilt.
Yeah.
Is like, well, it would be a shame for me not to.
Yeah. She showed you the light, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. Thanks, Mom.
Now we're two surgeries deep at this point.
Now we're two surgeries deep, and I guess I'll leave out most of the shenanigans at the hospital because there were shenanigans. We were stuck over there for Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah.
And we've got one of those, you know, rubber horse head masks that were all the rage back in 2013. And so we decided to put one, I decided to put that on, just kind of walk around the floor and
yeah.
you know, some kids laughed, others screamed. patients were like, or the nurses were like, get the hell back in your room, weirdo. So anyways, we had some shenanigans with that. I tried to steal the wheelchair the orderly left outside the room, which was kind of my way of, I guess, rebelling
yeah.
from my condition. It's like, I didn't care that my chest had just been cracked open less than 4 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to take this wheelchair and push myself down the hallway in this wheelchair and just grit my teeth through the pain and just enjoy the fact that I'm joyriding.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care. At this point, I'm joyriding. You can't stop me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
So the staff was awesome with putting up with my, with my shenanigans. So we get home and we're thinking, okay, a couple months of recovery. And it's going to be back to work, back to normal life. You know, the heart. So the whole time that the heart is pumping past this blockage, the heart is growing.
Okay.
Right. Because whenever you, it's like it's any other muscle, mm-hmm. right? You work it harder, it grows.
Yeah.
The anticipation was that after the coarctation had been dealt with by placing this super special Canadian stent in there, that the heart would atrophy back down to normal human being size.
Okay.
We go throughout the recovery. There's a couple little hiccups in the recovery. Mainly, my gallbladder decides to give up the ghost.
Oh, geez.
About 2 weeks after I'm released. And they couldn't get me in for a scan or removal for about 2 months. So every night I'm dealing with gallbladder pain and attacks. Anyways, that was all kinds of fun too. And again, Alicia just stayed by my side the whole time, middle of the night, dragging my ass to the ER because she's like, this, given your previous surgeries and this level of pain,
mm-hmm.
you know,
something's wrong.
Something is wrong. Right. So she dragged me to the ER a couple times.
And you're just going through living hell at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually started pretty much living off of, like plain turkey sandwiches from Jimmy John's.
Yeah.
Because that was like the only thing I could find that wouldn't give me some type of gallbladder attack.
Oh, geez.
Which is apparently a really good weight loss program. I lost like 20 some pounds. Gallbladder gets removed. Somewhere along the lines, they pick up on the fact that I'm anemic, probably because I haven't been able to eat meat or anything fatty. So I'm lacking red blood cells. So I get all kinds of iron infusions and things like that. And eventually go back to work.
Okay.
That's late August.
Of 2013?
Of 2013, right. At this time, they also decided to readmit me back to Lake Michigan to finish my EMT program because I had to medically withdraw.
Okay.
Because...
yeah, clearly.
Clearly. Yeah, they were like, yeah, we don't want you coming anywhere near having to lift a patient or something like that
when yeah.
you've got this. So like whenever I went to like kind of re-register, I'm like, oh, do I need to whatever? She's like, don't worry, it's all taken care of. And it was great going through the program all over again.
Yeah.
Again, really good students, really good instructor, love the subject matter. I was really enjoying myself. So now our daughter is due on September 11th.
Okay.
So I've got class September 11th. I get home, you know, Alicia's like, eh, you know, nothing. She starts going into contractions about 5 a.m. the next morning.
Okay.
We go to the hospital that evening because she just, it's, they're just not at that slow pace.
Yeah.
At that slow pace and everything. 4 o'clock the next morning, my daughter's born. We're like, yay.
So this is like the 13th now.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Friday the 13th.
Oh, awesome.
Yes. So anyways, the year ended on a really good note.
That's awesome.
And it was like, this year has been, like you said, living hell for just the anxiety leading up to the surgery, you know, the pain and discomfort from the surgery, pain and discomfort times two with the surgery, with the second surgery, gallbladder pain every night, gallbladder gets removed, you know, and all of a sudden here's the prize at the end of the, at the end of the race.
That's pretty incredible.
And it was great. So we go about living. And so we go back to the hospital every, they got me going up there every 3 months for checkups. The original goal was, you know, every 3 months, then 6 months, then nine, then 12.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So after 3 months, they start noticing during the regular echoes that, echocardiograms, excuse me, they start noticing that the heart's not atrophying back down the way it should.
Okay.
So they're saying, yeah, we're going to kind of keep an eye on this because it should be, there's no reason for it not to be.
Mm-hmm.
They said, there's one thing that it could be, but the odds of you having that on top of everything else is astronomical.
Yeah.
We go on just kind of watch, wait, and see for a while. And sure enough, the heart is not shrinking back down. They said, you have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy.
Oh, geez.
Which was the one in a million thing, which means that the heart.
You have just had the card stacked against you from the get-go.
Apparently. And I didn't even notice it until, well, I never actually noticed it.
Yeah.
You know, I played soccer whenever we lived in West Virginia. Marched band. I hiked with hiked in scouts. Really active youth, right? Mm-hmm. Spent a lot of time biking and you know mountain biking hills in West Virginia. Nothing symptomatic up to that point. And it's not one of those things that throws up a lot of symptoms either, though.
Yeah,
like the biggest symptom is like leg cramps, which is like the easiestly written off thing ever.
Well, yeah, I mean,
especially for active kids.
Yeah, it's like a million things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, oh, man, my legs hurt tonight. Yeah, well, you shouldn't have jumped off that bridge, you freaking knucklehead.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is a really big word for saying that your heart is bigger than it should be.
Okay.
Now, if you're familiar with the heart, there's a sac that surrounds it. It's kind of like a fibrous sac, which the name is escaping me right now. Pericardium, I believe.
Sounds right.
Sounds right. We'll go with it.
Such is my life.
It's science.
Yes, science.
So, and if that pericardium, if the heart starts bumping up against that and it's restricting the blood flow and everything, you're going to start getting less blood flow to the rest of your body. And it's just generally a bad thing.
Yeah.
So they're keeping an eye on it. They said, well, it hasn't grown, but it hasn't shrunk either. So it's bigger than it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to just kind of keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
So at that point, I'm handed off to another doctor who specializes with heart, HCM, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. It's the way the cool kids say it. I'm handed off to another doctor named Mark Norris.
Okay.
Again, really cool guy. I don't know what it is with cardiovascular doctors, but most of them are also shooters as well.
Really?
I think it has to do with the fact that you've got they've got cardiovascular surgeon money because my surgeon, Oye, Rick Oye, is a fantastic three-gun shooter.
Really?
Yeah. He is fast as hell, man.
That's awesome.
So we still keep in touch. He's usually, you know, making me jealous of, hey, man, here's my third LWRC that I just bought. I think I might turn this one into an SBR, but, you know, it's like, thanks, doc. So I actually went and shot a match with him.
Okay.
And like I said, just stupid fast. So they hand me off to Dr. Norris, who's also a shooter, but he is more of the clay pigeon trap and shoot kind of guy. You know, leather tweed jackets and
those guys,
high class kind of guy.
Oh yes,
really good dude. So I get handed off to him, and he takes over my medical history, and he's like, "Okay, so we've got a couple options here on the table."
Mm-hmm.
He goes, "One option is for a defibrillator because your heart rate is throwing out weird rhythms."
Okay.
Now at this point, they had put a little thing called a loop recorder.
Okay.
In my chest, which is almost like a real-time electrocardiogram.
Okay.
Or EKG. It downloads every night to a little base station next to my bed.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had something that felt like symptoms, I had a little like clicker thing that I would, you know, click it and it would like timestamp it. And they would look specifically at that time frame.
Okay. Makes sense.
Yeah. Really cool. I mean, the tech involved with all this stuff is it's just mind-blowing. That's
pretty incredible, actually.
It's some straight-up James Bond stuff.
Yeah.
So they're monitoring it. They get to monitor it real time.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, yeah, you know, the argument on the table is, do we lower your blood pressure with medication to help try to combat the HCM? But how do we also keep your heart rate from going weird in the event that it does? Because as a result of this HCM stuff, the heart growing bigger, there's a lot of scar tissue.
Okay.
Scar tissue tends to mess with the nodes and everything because your heart is a huge conductor.
Yeah.
Right? Electrical signals bouncing back and forth, and they're telling it when to pump, when to open up, things like that. So he is more on the camp of, look, we don't need to mess with this guy's quality of life any more than necessary.
Yeah.
So let's go with some low-dose medication. Let's see what he can tolerate without it becoming an issue.
Okay.
And then, you know, because we don't want to go throwing more devices in this guy than necessary.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. We go through that for a couple of years. They had me on a couple, like a beta blocker, which beta blockers are weird, man. It makes you feel like you're walking in quicksand.
Oh, really?
Like wet, soft, wet sand.
Yeah.
Because you're slow. And it's like your heart rate just is low. And it's like, I don't want to get out of bed. I'm feeling lazier than I normally am.
Yeah.
And it kind of sucks. So they can do things to kind of counteract that. You know, we're on that medication train for a while. And, you know, we're not losing any ground, but we're not gaining any ground either. Till one night, I'm sitting there, you know, watching TV. And apparently, because I didn't even notice it, because it happened so quickly and then corrected itself so quickly, my heart rate went from like 55 to like 200.
Holy shit.
Or 200 beats per minute, and then back to 55.
Really?
Yeah. Like, they called the next day and said, did you feel anything at that point? I said, no, I was sitting there watching TV. I said, yeah, that pretty much settles the argument. You're getting a defibrillator.
Okay.
Because if that happens and you can't, and your body doesn't correct it itself, because your body does amazing things. It's always trying to reach back to homeostasis.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, even whenever I had the coarctation, that blockage in the aorta, there was like a little vein or a little like auxiliary artery that had like built itself around there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like some X-Men, kind of thing.
You speak of that. My dad had, long story short, my dad ended up going to the doctor. They were worried about his heart. They did an angioplasty, angiogram. What the fuck is it?
Either angioplasty, angiogram.
Anyways. They went in to look at his heart.
Okay.
And basically, they had told him the same thing. They said, you know, at some point, you have had a heart attack. You know, we don't know when it was. You know, you obviously didn't feel it, but you've had a heart attack. You have an artery that is completely blocked, but your body has built its own bypass.
Isn't that awesome?
It's awesome. It's crazy to hear, but it's absolutely awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. That just blew my mind. I'm like, so my body healed itself?
Mm-hmm.
They're like, yeah. I'm like, I'm Wolverine.
I'm Wolverine, bitches.
That's right. So, anyways, the medication train has been derailed. Mm-hmm. We're officially, you know, team ICD at this point.
Okay.
So, ICD, intercostal defibrillator, that was the little thing that went down on just below my left armpit. It felt like a rounded off Altoid tin.
Okay.
Which took a lot of getting used to, man.
Yeah, just having something there constantly.
So weird, especially because I sleep on my left side. And it's like, I'm like, how do I get this thing? You know, the defibrillator is good to go.
Okay.
They're telling me all about it. They're telling me that it's just going to monitor it on top of your loop recorder. It's just going to be monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
If there's like, you can work out with it. You can do anything you want with it.
Okay.
They said, you know, we've got the same model in MMA fighters. You're good to go.
Okay.
Okay. I'm like, all right, cool.
Sweet. I'm starting fighting.
Yeah. No, because knowing my luck, the first shot I'd take would be like right in that rib and be like, nope, I'm done.
That hurt.
That was the shortest career ever. So anyways, got the defibrillator. And they just say, look, the most important thing you can do is just go about your life,
mm-hmm.
you know, just keep on going. Cause if this thing trips and shocks you, you know, you obviously needed it. So it just saved your life.
Mm-hmm.
And they're telling me just to go about my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I go back to the gym, start working out, you know, and it's feeling good because at this point I'm kind of getting past that whole like, is this thing going to shock me in the middle of the night and I'm not even going to know it?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they did a really good job of letting me know that this thing's not going to just randomly trip. If it hits you, you needed it.
Yeah.
They even showed me like, you know, the numbers and everything. And it was really cool because they had this like, looked like a hockey puck on a cord.
Okay.
That I would have to tuck underneath my arm whenever I went up there to do a device read or upload or update or anything. I actually had to get like device updates.
Okay.
Like it was telling you real time. They're like, okay, let's look back 3 days ago. You at the gym 4 o'clock in the morning? I said, yeah, you know, yeah, there you are. Let me guess, cardio that day?
Hmm.
No shit. You know?
Yeah.
It was just kind of cool. You know, the tech again is just, it's just outstanding. So we go about life. Life is good until February of this year.
Okay.
So February this year, I'm at work. I'm doing a patrol. There's a lot of snow and basically having to shovel my way to where I got to go.
Okay.
Right. And I know there's going to be 100 people screaming, you've got a heart condition. Do not pick up a snow shovel, you know,
but that's not you,
but that's unfortunately, it's not me, you know, doing what I got to do. And it gets to a point where I'm like, I'm going to black out. Something's wrong here.
Yeah.
So I get back inside.
So you felt it coming, though.
I felt something coming. I get back inside and I sit down because I'm like, well, if I get shocked, I don't want to compound the problem of my heart with hypothermia,
mm-hmm.
being out in the middle of a snowdrift. So I'm going to go back inside and sit down and just wait for this thing to hit.
Mm-hmm.
So I go inside, I sit down, nothing happens.
And that's got to be a strange feeling of you're waiting and waiting and waiting,
yeah.
and nothing's coming.
It feels like all the muscles in your neck are now cables, like there's twisting. It's just like you're sitting there just going, okay, come on,
mm-hmm.
let's do this thing, because I can feel my heart rate doing something, but I can't quite, you know, I'm checking my own pulse and it's like, it's, there's no rhyme or reason to it.
Yeah.
And it's weirding me out. So, you know, I take my little clicker thing, timestamp it, send it to U of M, and they see it at U of M. I drop my doctor a message. He's like, that looked weird. Why don't you come up and we're going to do a stress test.
Okay.
So I do a stress test. They got me all hooked up to the machines and everything, the tube in the mouth and everything. It looks like a scuba rig without, without the air hose, you know, connected to it. So I'm doing the running and everything on the treadmill. And the leads that are hooked up to me for the EKG, they're watching my pulse, and it's like it would go like 48 to start,
mm-hmm.
because they were like, "Hey, is your pulse usually this low?" I said, "Yeah, it's pretty low." So it would go like 48, 52, you know, 56, 64, 70, 72, 78, 48, and just start going like it would go back.
Hmm.
And they're like, what?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you're doing that, you shouldn't.
Yeah. I'm like, I didn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
I just, I'm still running and my heart rate is dropping. It's that's not the way it's supposed to work. So they had me run for a little bit longer until I'm just like, I can't, I'm done, mm-hmm. you know, which really sucked because I was a decent runner. I hate running, but I was decent at it at one point. That was kind of kicking the nuts. So they're collecting all this data and everything, and they send me out to the waiting room, and they finally call me back, and Doc Norris sits me down and he says, all right, he draws like the little, oh, what's the word I'm looking for here? Looks, you know, the little squiggly line.
Yeah, the heart rhythm
thing. Thank mm-hmm. you. And he says, for as long as I've known you, this has been the delay between these two waves.
Okay.
From today, this has been the delay. It's like, we don't know why.
Okay.
But we do know what's going on is that your heart rate is getting out of rhythm to the point where it just wants to reset itself. And it's usually about that 70 to 80 some beat range.
Yeah. So your heart was almost defibbing itself.
Yeah. But at a way lower
level, yeah.
Right. So I apologize to any, you know, cardiovascular people listening that it's like, if I'm screwing up the explanation, I apologize.
We get the idea.
Yeah. So they're like, yeah, we need to do something about this.
Yeah.
So they send me back to electrophysiology, the same people who did the ICD. And eventually we get to the point where like, yeah, you need a pacemaker.
Jeez.
So I said, okay, what's that? They're like, well, we're going to take out the loop recorder. We're going to take out the ICD, put in this dual chamber pacemaker, and it's going to do the job of all three.
Okay.
I'm like, okay, well, you know, one device is better than three.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take it. So that's pretty much where we're at now. So basically since February, my heart rate has been about 40 some beats a minute.
Wow.
I would get done doing patrols at work, lots of stairs, heavy gear, kind of on a timeline kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's stop and have one of my supervisors, who's also a paramedic, like, he's like taking my pulse. He's like, your shit's at 48 beats a minute, man. That's not right.
Yeah, it's low.
That's bad.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, so now that's taken care of and I'm at a steady electrically driven 60 beats a minute.
That's good. That's good to hear.
So hopefully I really hope that's the end of the line, man.
I hope so too.
I mean, besides like the occasional like battery change out.
Yeah.
I'm done with freaking surgeries, dude. I'm really hoping that's the end of it when it comes to all this. Cause it's been a long, I mean, I'm sitting here trying to figure out how long it's taken to explain all this. I've talked for a long time, man.
No, it's awesome. You know, and the thing that I think goes a little unnoticed in the story, but doesn't go fully unnoticed, is the fact that you never let that stop your life. Any of what you were doing, any of these surgeries, any of this, you never let it stop your life.
I tread carefully at points,
mm-hmm.
but eventually it was just like, look, man, I just got to go all in.
Yeah.
So it was what it was. It was like I stopped looking at it as a burden, started looking at it like an insurance plan.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great way to look at it, you know? Like, you're going to have to do this. You can't just be this guy that's going to sit on the couch all day and worry.
Right. Because that's even worse for your heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the way I wrap up all these episodes is I ask for one piece of advice. So if you had one piece of advice to give somebody, what would it be?
Being able to write down positive influences and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I really was looking at it going like, damn, I got a lot of people in my corner.
Yeah.
And that's a good feeling.
That is awesome.
You know, I mean, my mid-level supervisor came into work because I was supposed to be off on medical starting last Monday.
Okay.
But somehow I got forced for overtime on Saturday.
Okay.
He came in on his day off and like pretty much hunted me down.
Yeah.
And was like, hey man, do you mind if I pray with you? Yeah. He's a really devout guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know what? I don't mind at all. You know, this, sure. And I walked away from that with just this huge feeling of peace.
Yeah.
So the best piece of advice I ever got really wasn't a piece of advice.
Okay.
It was just more of a mindset.
Okay.
So after the big surgery, and we talked about, you know, the 2A stuff and everything,
mm-hmm.
But after the big surgery, I went to a rifle training course down in Eastern Panhandle, West Virginia.
Okay.
With Pat Rogers. And this guy had been around, I mean, he'd been carrying a gun for more years than both of us have been alive.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, the war years in New York as a cop in Central Robbery,
mm-hmm.
Vietnam, Desert Storm, just everything after there. But he was the most laid back guy ever. And every time you would talk to him, it's like, hey, man, you know, it's an easy day, right? Mm-hmm. If you were still breathing at the end of the day, it was an easy day.
Okay.
You know, it was like, life is good. He always kept saying life is good. And that's the challenge coin that was made after he passed. That was like his thing, was life is good.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I guess it was just, don't let it stop you. And I said at the beginning of this whole podcast that it was like, this whole thing came out of the dark,
mm-hmm.
right? Now looking back on that, it's like, I took a lot of shit for granted.
Absolutely.
Between here and there.
Yeah.
You know, and it just not taking, just letting like the little things get to me and ruin my, like letting 10 seconds ruin the rest of the day.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it ain't worth it. It's just not worth it to linger on that. It's like, yeah, well, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, I got a flat tire, whatever. I changed it. Easy day, you know,
mm-hmm.
and just take time to enjoy the little things, you know, your family, your loved ones. Don't be afraid to ask for help.
No, that's a big one. Asking for help. That's hard for all of us to do, but it really is important.
Yeah. And just stay in it.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to get kicked. You're going to get knocked down. You're going to have your freak out moments,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, why calling in tonight? Yeah. How about sudden fucking death? You know,
yeah.
You know, you're going to have those moments, but you just got to stay in the fight. You know, it's stay in it, you know, and every day is the fight, but it's the easiest day ever.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Cause I'm going to get out of here, you know, put my daughter to bed before I came down here, and I'm going to go home to a less than perfect life, but it's the best thing I've got, man. I'll never take it for granted.
That's powerful, man. That's really powerful. Kyle, thank you so much for joining me tonight, man.
Zach, it's been a pleasure being on here, man.
It absolutely has. I really appreciate you being here.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, buddy. I heard it's a motherfucker.
Statistic.
Yeah.